Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Science Mixtape, and as the cold weather starts to draw in, we are well and truly into the season of coughs and sneezes and office flu. Why do we get ill? How can we cure ourselves? And how, in fact, do our bodies work? We think we know the answers to a lot of these questions. We know about bacteria and viruses, what causes a heart attack, and how our joints work. But what would you have thought 400 years ago? Well, joining me today is social historian Dr. Jennifer Evans from the University of Hertfordshire to take us on a magical mystery tour back to the 17th century and the world of early modern medicine. Good morning, Jen. Thank you for joining us.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
So I find the world of early modern medicine infinitely fascinating because we think that our medical knowledge today is sort of unshakable and correct. We think our ideas about the body are so different to what they were 400 years ago that it makes you wonder, what will people be thinking about our knowledge now in 400 years' time? I mean, they're probably going to have nanopots altering our hormones or like changing single cells, and they'll be like, God, how did these people used to fire radiation at their bodies? It's so primitive.
Yeah, we tend to think that we're the kind of pinnacle of medical knowledge and science, but really it's changing all the time. And that's what I find fascinating, this kind of idea that what we think we know can change at any given moment, and it does change over time.
And I'm particularly excited because today our experiment is going to be an ancient remedy to cure the common cold. And I actually have a cold, so I'm really intrigued to see if it works. Looking at the ingredients we've got, like it's looking promising. And we're going to be cooking it up right here in the studio. All you need if you want to take part at home is a bottle of claret wine. I told you this was going to be good. A pound of blue currants, that's 435 in grams. 8 spoonfuls of sugar and access to a stove. So go grab all of those things and stay tuned. And of course, as always, we want to hear from you. So you can tweet us at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio. And our little brain teasers this week, we've got two because I just couldn't choose. One is quite silly and one is a bit more, you know, factual take home. So what nuts give you a cold? And what would happen to you if you were struck by the falling sickness? If you think you know the answer to either or both of those questions, tweet us in. And now, Jen, it's your mixtape. What are we starting today with?
Well, today we're starting with my favourite artist of all time and my favourite song of all time, which is Tom McRae with Bloodless.
We think that we're the ones, we're the bright unconquered suns. Wait a while, we'll watch the light grow stale. And we smell so very clean, but we're the oil in this machine. And this machine is going wrong. So choose your sides when it comes to the fight. You're bloodless. So tell me again, what am I feeling? You know me so well.
Trepanning, drilling a circular hole in the skull, was used throughout the early modern period and beyond. But the oldest trepan skull ever found dates to a Neolithic burial site in France and is more than 7,000 years old.
And that was producer Kyle with the first of our ancient medical remedies. Welcome back, Kyle.
Hey.
He's been busy finishing off his PhD, but is the person that originally created our jingle and produced a lot of our early shows. It's so nice to have you back.
It's great to be back. Thanks.
Cool. Well, Jen, so back to early modern medicine. Now, I feel like we really need to set the scene because when you say 17th century, I'm still like in my head, I'm not quite sure like who was in power, what were people doing, how did they live? What was it like back then?
So the 17th century really is coming out of the tail end of the Tudor era, which is the one that everybody knows about because of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I. And then we start to move into the Stuart era. So this is the era when Charles I is in power. And then, of course, we hit the bumpy, rocky road where Charles I loses his head. And there's the civil wars across England. And yes, we have the interregnum where Oliver Cromwell is in power. And the country becomes very puritanical for a while. It's led by very kind of radical groups. And then we enter the Restoration in 1660, where Charles II comes to the throne. And his court is very lavish. It's known for being very luxurious. And everyone has a kind of popular image in their mind of Charles II with his spaniels and lots of plays and lots of satin fabrics and, you know, very, very luxurious time. So that's the kind of era that we're talking about.
So luxury, but for normal people, it'd be much more of a kind of living off the land existence.
Yeah, so the courts are very wealthy and there's lots of money there. But for most people, they live a fairly rural lifestyle. So we have some big urban centres, as we do now. You know, the capital, London, is fairly urban. Lots of people living in London at this time. But outside of that, most of the country is still relatively rural. People are farming, living off the land. And there's quite a lot of poverty. Not many people have lots and lots of money. A small proportion of society has the money and the power.
And kind of what have been the like average lifespan?
So average lifespan is really interesting because it gets thrown out by a couple of interesting factors. But one estimate is that your average life expectancy is around 32.
Oh my God.
I am officially got in my last year to live. So that's always a happy thought. But it's thrown out by the fact that child mortality is very high, particularly infant mortality. So your chances of surviving your first year of life are very, very low. And your chances of surviving until you're five are quite low. But if you can make it to your fifth birthday, then you stand a pretty good chance. And they consider old age to be anywhere from around 50 onwards. And if you make it to your fifth birthday, you've got a fairly good chance of living a good long lifespan.
Yeah, and so other than the kind of like classic childhood diseases that would kill you as a baby, what were people dying of as adults?
So the early modern period is not particularly safe in terms of your health and well-being. There's an awful lot of things that can kill you at this time. We're talking about an era before antiseptics and before antibiotics. So if you get a cut, you might end up getting blood poisoning and kind of infection that way. So that can be lethal. And then there's a whole range of diseases. The most famous ones that people are dying of that we know about in kind of the popular mindset are venereal disease or syphilis. It's running rampant across Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries and it's very dangerous. And the plague, of course, we've all heard about bubonic plague.
Yes.
So there's major outbreaks of plague throughout the 17th century and it kills an awful lot of people and it kills them very quickly. So if you catch the plague, you may die within 3 days. So that's a big killer. And things like smallpox are very problematic at this time. And so there's a whole range of different things that could send you to your grave at this time.
Now, say I'm a wench from ye olde London. How did I think my body worked? Because it was quite different, wasn't it, what they thought?
Yeah, so the 17th century is thinking about medicine based on a model called the four humours, which is actually a very ancient model. It comes from ancient Greece, from Hippocrates, and is refined by the Roman physician Galen. But the four humours model states that your body is composed of four major fluids: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, which is also called choler, and black bile, which is called melancholy. And you need to keep those four humours in balance in order to maintain your health. And I think one of the most fascinating things about the way they thought about the body in the 17th century is that everybody has their own individual constitution or makeup and balance of those humours. So if you catch a cold and I catch a cold in the 17th century, they'll be different because your makeup of humours will be different from my makeup of humours.
The imbalance that has given me a cold is different to whatever is causing your imbalance.
Exactly. And so medicine is really individual, and cures are quite individual and have to be adapted to each individual person. And of course they do have diseases that they can see that they manifest in the same way in different people. So plague, for example, is very similar. But underlying this, there's still this idea that disease is very individual and it is unique to each person.
And would there have been kind of stereotypical ways that they thought about, like, were certain people likely to have certain types of makeup of these humours?
Yeah, so the balance of humours in your body really dictates everything about you. And so people who have a lot of black bile in their bodies, a lot of melancholy, are thought to be more liable to the disease melancholy. So depression and kind of feelings of sadness. But they're also thought to be the more kind of scholarly people. So scholars are thought to be particularly prone to feeling low and lethargic because they have more melancholy in their bodies. People with yellow bile in their bodies, choleric people as they're called, are thought to be kind of very bilious and quarrelsome and quick to anger. Mm. And so they're more liable to get diseases that are associated with kind of heating the body very quickly. So the humoral makeup really dictates everything about your health and well-being.
That thing about the melancholy, that's just reminded me, when Shakespeare's characters, you talk about the villain as being the melancholy person.
Yeah, that's to do with the humoral makeup, because of course Shakespeare's living in early modern England, and this is the medical framework he's writing about and using in his plays, so it's what frames his ideas about the body as well.
But don't we also have like the words like sanguine? We still use that.
Yeah.
That, does that come from?
Yep. So a sanguine person in the 17th century is one who's dominated by blood. And if you're a man, it's particularly good to be sanguine because blood is the most important of the humours, the most important fluid in the body. And so a sanguine man is thought to be most perfect in terms of masculinity and the manliness of the body. Whereas a phlegmatic man who's cold and wet, and phlegm is cold and wet, obviously, as we all know, they're kind of soft and flabby. And a bit less perfect.
I feel quite sanguine right now, I think.
Excellent. Good, yeah. Good way to be.
So, I was wondering, is it only the imbalance of humours? Because there was this thing called miasma, right, where people used to think that it was something to do with the air. Or
yeah, so miasma is very closely connected. It's a different kind of way of thinking about health at this time, but miasma is basically where putrid smells and the smell of corruption and decay can permeate into your body, because the way they think about the body, it's much more porous and much more open to the outside world. And those corrupt smells then permeate into your body and corrupt the humours on the inside. And so that then causes problems with your humours and imbalances that need to be redressed.
And so in terms of your illness is caused by an imbalance, what were their kind of ways of treating that?
So there's really two approaches if you're living at this time. The first one is what we might call kind of prophylactic or preventative. And it's based on a model called the six non-naturals, which were created by Galen or thought up by Galen. And there's six factors that you regulate in order to keep your body healthy. And these should sound really familiar to modern listeners, because they're the kind of things that the government are always telling us now that we need to regulate and moderate. And so they are your environment, where you live, the kind of air you breathe, exercise, and how much exercise you're getting, the amount of sleep that you're getting, the food that you're taking in, your mental state. So for them, it's about balancing out your worry and your leisure time in your brain. Mm. And then evacuations, so regular bowel movements and other kinds of bodily evacuations as well.
God, that is so similar. Just like eat well, sleep well, don't get too stressed.
Yeah.
They must have got some things right. You know, people didn't die all the time.
Exactly. And then if that fails and you get sick, because most of the diseases that they're thinking about and the way they're thinking about them are imbalances of humours, they're usually the build-up of a humour inside the body. And so the treatment regimes are normally pretty horrifically about removing those excess humours from the body. And so the most famous one from the 17th century is bleeding. Everybody's heard about
using leeches
in medicine, or just cutting into the veins at various parts of the body to release excess blood and build up. But they're also fond of emetics, anything that will make you vomit, purges that push things the other way as well, so provoking what they like to call provoking you to go to stool.
Laxatives.
Anything that will remove those excesses and those corrupt humours from the body are the way to kind of redress your health and your balance.
And did it actually work? Did they actually ever cure people these ways?
It's one of the kind of popular myths about the 17th century and early modern medicine is that doctors just go around killing people. And of course, they think they're doing a lot of good. And as a social historian, it's my job to kind of think within their framework and to think how they thought. And so I read a lot of books where they certainly think they're doing a lot of good, but, you know, they're taking pints of blood from people who are already weakened by disease, and they're provoking excessive, you know, laxative effects. It's not necessarily what we would consider now to be a good idea.
Yeah, because what we know now is that your immune cells, your white blood cells are in your blood, and if you're removing all your blood, it's going to make it harder for your body to fight the disease.
Exactly. And there are people at the time who think bloodletting in particular is a bad idea. There's a whole big movement called chemical medicine in the 17th century, and the chemist, the very famous chemical physicians, suggest that it's just cruel and barbaric and that you shouldn't be taking blood from people. But yeah, I'm not too sure about whether they cured many people. They certainly thought they were.
Well, in the next section, we're going to be trying out a little cure of our own. But before we come on to that, what is your second song, Jen?
So my second song reminds me of my teen years and my A-levels, and it's Ryan Adams' Answering Bell. Let your tears fall and touch my skin. Then your thunderclouds could rage and bear. I will collect them all for you and
butterfly charms. Oh girl, build your wish away. Oh girl, build your wish away. But I'm just saying hi to your answering bell.
Leeches have been used in medicine for thousands of years, but there was a leech craze in the 19th century led by a French physician. It resulted in barrels of leeches being shipped around the world and wild populations being severely damaged. This led to the creation of prosperous leech farms.
That's crazy. It's kind of like similar to how today you get like modern day cravings for superfoods or whatever. And now there's like the avocado crisis in Mexico.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, medicine leading markets. Right, so what are we doing, Jen? We've got our claret wine and our currants and our sugar. How common was it for people to make their own remedies?
So it's really common in the 17th century to make your own medical remedies. There are physicians, there are apothecaries, and there are surgeons, but physicians tend to be very, very expensive, and medical care in general tends to be quite expensive. And so a lot of people turn to self-help first, and then they'll seek out what we might call professional, although that's a dubious term for this era, professional help later on. And particularly women are charged with learning about medicine. It's a part of their kind of housewifely role, is to know how to treat people in their household. And they treat their family members, they treat their servants. Some very charitable, noble women treat other members of their local communities as well. And so it's really quite common. And we know about the kinds of medical recipes that they're using because those who were wealthy enough kept written manuscript collections of medical remedies. And these circulate around, and they have social currency. So if I have a really great remedy for nausea and I pass it on to you, then you owe me a favour. And so when you get a really good remedy for something, you might then send it back to me, and it reinforces a kind of friendship network. And this is happening all over the country. People are sharing remedies, but women in particular treat a whole range of things, and not just minor cuts and bruises. These collections contain remedies for cancer, for gout, for kind of serious major ailments. So yeah, it's very common for people to be treating themselves in the home.
And where did you find this remedy?
So this remedy comes from a book from the 1690s, and it's attributed to Mary Chantrell. And if you want to see this, you can actually look on the Wellcome Library London website. They've digitized lots of their recipe books from this era, so you can have a look at them and kind of go through them and see what kinds of things that they were making.
Cool. Okay, well, what is the first thing that we need?
So the first thing we need is a bottle of claret wine, and then to that we are going to add our pound of currants.
Right, I'm going to ask Kyle to kindly weigh out the currants and add them in. There we go. So we're actually only doing half, not the full bottle, because my saucepan isn't big enough. So if you are listening at home, it's half a pound, not a whole pound.
Yeah, the reason the remedies are so big is because they make them on bulk, and then they store them and keep them for a very long time. And now we are going to boil this down and simmer it until half of the wine has disappeared, so until it's reduced by half. And then when it's heated up and is boiling nicely, we're going to add in some sugar.
And I'm particularly proud of myself because I've managed to source a camping stove for this. It's set up safely outside, don't worry, not in the studio. Health and safety is very important here on Science Mixtape. So we're actually going to be simmering it live. Kai, would you like to fire our stove up?
Perfect. There we go. We have ignition.
Excellent.
Cool.
I'm very excited about this. This is the first time ever I've kind of made a 17th century medical recipe. So.
Oh my God. Awesome. Wow. Glad that we can help. What are some of the strangest remedies that you've come across?
So there are some pretty strange remedies in use at this time. There's some rather unusual ones that I've come across. So at the minute I'm working on a project on men's sexual health, and I've been looking at recipes for when men have bruised their intimate area by horse riding, and using cow dung as a kind of plaster is an interesting one.
Really?
Yeah. One of my favourite ones of all time is for the plague, and this works on a medical system called transference. So it's not quite a humoral remedy, but you basically pluck the bottom of a live pigeon, hold the pigeon to your plague sores, and then release the pigeon, and the disease is supposed to have transferred over into the pigeon, and when the pigeon dies, the disease will die out from your body as well.
Oh my God, so you're getting a live bird,
yes,
plucking its bum and then holding it to your face,
yeah,
or your sores.
Yeah, the live bird's probably preferable because one of the remedies for gout in this era is to take a live puppy and to cut it in half and then hold the soggy side to your gouty leg. So I'd take a live pigeon over a dead puppy.
Yeah, definitely.
This is really not that far from sacrifice, right?
No, it's a little bit strange. But my favourite one that doesn't involve, you know, the slaughter of poor innocent animals, for miscarriage, for a woman who worries that she's having a miscarriage, you need a loaf of bread and you slice it into slices and you toast them individually. So you toast a slice of bread, coat it with spices and lay it to the stomach hot. And when it cools down, you then take the next slice and toast that, and you kind of interchange them until you get through the whole loaf of bread.
So a whole spicy loaf for your unborn baby.
Yes. It's warming and nourishing, I think, is the idea behind it. But I just love the idea of, you know, toast as a remedy for miscarriage.
Just going back to what Kyle said, was there a spiritual side to the way that they healed?
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, this is an era where Protestantism, the country is largely dominated by Protestantism and at various moments by quite strong Puritan movements as well. And most people at this time have a very religious way of thinking about health and healing. And in part, this is because the primary origin of all ill health is God. And so there are some that are very obvious. So sinful behaviour, sexual immorality could end up meaning that you're struck down with venereal disease because you've been illicit and immoral and you need to be punished. Mm. And the plague is sometimes seen as kind of a punishment for wider sins of society as well. And so part of what they need to do in order to affect cure is to repent for their sins.
Right.
And some people believe that if you haven't repented adequately, that God won't allow medicines to work and you'll just remain sick. So it's really quite a crucial part. For those people who think that they're not wicked and not sinful and are very pious, illness is also a trial of your faith. It's something to test how much you believe in God and to reaffirm your kind of piety. And so people look for signs of ill health and illness to judge their own kind of spiritual well-being. We see this in diaries over and over where people praise God for their recovery or praise God from allowing their family to survive when another family hasn't. Mm. And so the religious element and prayer in particular is a very, very important part of healing rituals in this era.
And actually, considering some of the things you've just described, it almost would be like, thanks be to God that this has kind of worked.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think maybe there was a placebo effect? Because we do know now that there is an actual benefit from taking placebo pills if you believe it's the real thing. Like, that's been proven.
Yeah, I think it's difficult to figure out. You know, we only have their word to go on. We don't really know what's going on when they take these medicines. But I think there possibly, in some cases, might be a placebo effect. You know, doing something is better than doing nothing. And particularly with these self-made remedies, I think the action of actually putting together a remedy and trying to do something to improve your health was probably very beneficial to some people and helped them feel like they were
at least doing something to get better.
Having that sense of what we might call agency, I suppose, doing something, taking some action is probably quite important.
Yeah. Speaking of which, producer Carl, how is our own remedy looking?
Well, it's smelling gorgeous.
It does. It smells like mulled wine, doesn't it?
Yeah, really good. So it started bubbling, so should reduce
Excellent.
By half soon.
Cool. Excellent. Well, let's go on to our next song and let it carry on bubbling away.
So the next song is Stevie Wonder, Signed, Sealed, Delivered, I'm Yours. And this is because I got married a couple of weeks ago and this was my first dance song.
Oh.
So I'm going to relive it without the embarrassing dancing.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, shout out to the lucky man.
Suffering from persistent headaches, muscle cramps, or stomach ulcers? Once upon a time, doctors may have prescribed an elixir containing human flesh, blood, or bone. So-called corpse medicine was a disturbingly common practice. The Romans believed that the blood of fallen gladiators could even cure epilepsy.
Well, you did say that it was the most powerful of the humours.
Yeah, and corpse medicine's really interesting. It's still around in the 17th century. In particular, they're big fans of using the hands of hanged men to stroke swellings and buboes and horrible bits on the body. So they're still very much using what they call mummified flesh and then, you know, dead bits of people to cure.
They really like using other dead things on your body, don't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, it seems to be a little bit of a trend.
Well, so, didn't that continue for a long time? Because mummies medicine, this was like a big craze a bit later, right? Where people wanted ground down mummies.
Yeah,
so that even continued into like the 18th century.
Yeah, it's a very long-standing belief.
Wow. So what got you interested in this area yourself?
So I'm a bit of a random story. As an undergraduate, I did much more what we might call mainstream social and political history. I did look at the early modern period, but I was also looking at the medieval period as well. And in my third and final year, I did not get onto the module that I wanted to take and was bumped to my second choice, which was about the body and sexuality in the 17th and 18th centuries. And the second weekend, I was like, this is the best thing that has ever happened, ever. It's the best area of research. And that was it, done. I never looked back. And then it kind of developed from there, because my particular area of interest is reproductive ill health and sexual health.
Gosh, that must be fascinating back then.
Yeah, it is. It's really, really fascinating. But again, I kind of got to it through fluke. I think that's the way most academics get to their areas, is something sparks their interest and they just kind of follow it. We can't let it go. So yeah.
So what have you like discovered about the way they thought of sexual health and fertility and stuff back then?
So one of the things I think that is really interesting is the humoral model that I was mentioning earlier is very heavily gendered. And so men are seen to have the better balances of humours. They're hotter and drier, and women are seen as cold and wet. And those qualities relate to the humours that abound in the body. But women being cold and wet means they're liable to a whole range of diseases that men won't necessarily get. And infertility plays into that, because women's bodies being too cold and wet tends to lead to infertility.
Interesting.
I've spent a lot of time thinking, my first book was about how aphrodisiacs were understood in the 17th century. And in part, I got to this through this humoral model, because we tend to think about aphrodisiacs now as being just about lust and libido and, you know, having a nice evening. But in the 17th century, they didn't really separate that kind of lust and desire from the way they thought about conception. And so it's very closely connected in that respect.
So was it like the more lust you had, the more likely you were to conceive?
Yeah, in part, this is because in the 17th century, there are two ways of thinking about conception. And one of the ones that dominates is that both men and women produce seed, what we might call seminal matter. And that seed mixes in the womb. So you need both parties to orgasm in order for a conception to occur. And so women's pleasure is very important for a large part of the 17th century. That does start to change in the 18th century.
Yeah, I was going to say, they must lose that, because...
Yeah, they do. I mean, there are people at the time who are well aware that there are lots of women who have babies who don't love their husbands and don't enjoy their sex lives, and they can see the evidence in front of them. But one of the medical theories is that, you know, both partners need to be enjoying it for a conception to occur. And so aphrodisiacs at this time are very much more fertility medicine some people are using them just for pleasure purposes, but they are much more tied into infertility and reproduction than they are for us today.
So how much did they know about the actual, you know, what is in seminal fluid? Because this was around the same time that they were developing microscopes and things.
It's actually in the 17th century that they discover both the eggs and the sperm. So in the 1670s they start to do experiments, and one of my favorite stories is about the man who discovered sperm initially. And he's not a medical man per se, he's a microscope enthusiast, and someone sends him some seed from a man with gonorrhea, and he looks at it under the microscope and he sees little animals in it, and he calls them animalcules, but he thinks it's gonorrhea, and someone suggests to him he should check. So he then looks at his own sperm in order to double check, and of course he has them too, these little animalcules, and so he discovers the sperm.
Yeah, so his name was Antoine van Leeuwenhoek.
Yeah, I didn't want to try and say it because my pronunciation is terrible, but yeah.
And because you were saying with infertility, they always thought it was the female's fault because she was kind of the cold and wet one. So did that mean men didn't have a men couldn't be infertile?
So this is where my research has taken me. I spent a lot of time reading medical books about infertility and how they understood it. And historians were repeatedly saying that infertility in the past was always blamed on women. It was always the woman's fault. And I just personally don't believe that that was the case. You read these medical books, and the thing that really struck me was that they have tests for infertility. But these tests aren't just what is wrong with the woman, how do we test her? These are tests for men and women. And if it's always the fault of the woman, why do you need to test the man? And one medical book that I read by the very popular writer William Salmon in the early 18th century, he writes this throwaway note about men and women often fight about whose fault it is. So you have arguments between couples. And so he recommends these tests, and then you can figure out exactly which party's to blame. So they are very well aware that men can be infertile as well.
What are those tests?
So the tests are pretty amazing. I love these. I wouldn't recommend trying them as a way to discover if you're infertile, but they are quite amusing. So the first one is that each partner takes some barley seeds and their own pot, and you plant your barley seeds, and then you water them with your own urine. And whoever grows first, that partner is fertile, and the one that doesn't grow is the infertile culprit in the relationship. And if that doesn't work, your other option is to take a lettuce leaf each and to again urinate on them. And whoever's evaporates first is infertile.
I love it. That's amazing. That's like a horoscope.
It's a little bit... a little bit unusual, but we still use urine today to diagnose pregnancy and a whole range of things. So again, similar ideas, but a different way of executing it, perhaps.
And how did that play into the idea of, because I know your research also touches on men and masculinity and ideas of masculinity back then, which I think is really interesting, because I think our ideas of masculinity are changing again in modern day.
Yeah, so it's... again, because of this idea that it was always blamed on women, this is in part is connected to the fact that they want to see men's bodies as more perfect. Because humorally speaking, they should be more perfect. They're warmer, they are the more perfect beings. They're rational beings, which is again through their heat, which gives them their place to rule and govern. And men's bodies, while not completely central to claiming masculinity, are very important for it. And one of the reasons is that a man should grow up, marry, and then father children and become head of household. So he should become a patriarch. And to access patriarchal power, it's better if you've got children, because it shows that you're virile, and it also shows domestic harmony. And they have lots of concerns about men who can't perform sexually, not satisfying their wives, and those wives then running off and having an affair and cuckolding their husbands. And the danger there is that if the wife gets pregnant by somebody else, the man is raising a child that's not his own, and it will disrupt lines of inheritance. So infertility can be a pretty major deal for 17th century men.
And I just want to pick up on something you said in that explanation. You said men's bodies were warmer and drier, so they were more rational, and that was why they were the ones that governed. I think that's so interesting, because these days we say women are irrational because of their hormones that give them mood swings. And that's just so the same idea is that our bodies are making us irrational. But back then it's because we were wet and cold. And now it's because we have hormones that men don't.
Similar ideas, different explanations for what's going on.
That's so interesting. That's exactly what this is showing me. It's like we think today that science is kind of unchanging, but actually...
yeah, it is unchanging, but I think science changes, and the way we think about things changes, but it's always tied to social and cultural ideas and anxieties. And those anxieties don't necessarily change that much over time. You know, infertility has always been an anxiety for people, and men's and women's roles in relationship to each other have always been an anxiety. And so we just find new ways of talking about it and new ways of explaining it, but those kind of undercurrents are still there.
It's almost like we interpret the science, but with the biases that we have from our culture. So we see the answers that we want to in the science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm probably going to have some angry scientists yell at us in a minute, but yeah.
What is your fourth song?
So my fourth song is related to when I'm working. When I work, I tend to listen to film scores, because if I listen to anything with words in it, I write the words out, and then my books would probably be a slightly less enjoyable read with random song lyrics in
them.
Yeah,
that happens to me as well. I have to always listen to things that I'm not going to sing along to.
So I listen to a lot of film scores, and at the minute I'm currently in love with the film score from Oblivion. So my fourth song is M83 featuring Suzanne Sandfort, and it's the title track from that soundtrack.
In ancient Egypt, lizard blood, dead mice, mud, and moldy bread were all used as topical ointments and dressings, and women were sometimes dosed with horse saliva as a cure for an impaired libido.
Science. News.
A mind-controlled robot arm gives back sense of power to a paralysed man.
Cleaner world leading to an increase in hospital allergy emissions up 33% in 5 years.
The Skia Pirelli lander crashes into Mars.
A medical one for you in the first ever direct comparison between real doctors and digital ones. Real doctors outperform Dr. Google in diagnostic accuracy.
Studies find that 39% of people are put off from seeing the doctor because they have to speak to a receptionist.
The boy with three parents is given a clean bill of health.
Wait, I'm going to pick you up on that. So the boy with three parents, is this the one where they had a different mitochondrial DNA parent?
Yeah, so this idea is it's a new technique that tries to limit the transfer of disease that transfers through mitochondrial DNA. And so what they did is they take the egg and sperm of two parents.
Hang on, should we just say, in case any of our listeners don't know, what mitochondrial DNA is?
Yeah, so mitochondrial DNA is DNA of a substance that's in the stuff around the center of the cell. And it that's what helps produce energy that your body uses to survive.
So obviously when you've got the egg, you've got the nucleus with the DNA in the egg, and then you've got all the other stuff that's going to give the energy for the egg to divide once it's, you know, become an embryo with the sperm. So you can only get those from the mother, is the point.
So that's the problem, that actually if your mother has a disease that's associated with that mitochondrial DNA, she can pass it on to her children. So they're trying to develop a technique where that doesn't happen. So what they did is they took as the sperm and egg from mum and dad and combined them so that they were fertilized. And at the same time, they took a donor egg from somebody else and combined the sperm with that donor egg. Then after they're fertilized, they were able to transfer the nucleus from the original egg into the new donor egg. And what that means is all of the stuff around this nucleus now doesn't have the same mitochondrial DNA, and then that person can grow up without the kind of diseases that are inherited.
And they won't pass it on. Yeah. Wow, that's like cut and paste with like your nucleus. It's crazy.
It's amazing what they can do these days.
I really love this story about the mind-controlled robot arm. So this is the first time we've ever had something like this. It's to a man called Nathan Copeland, who's 28. And 10 years ago, he was in a car crash and became semi-paralyzed. So no sensation from the chest downwards. And they've managed to surgically wire a robot arm to his brain. So the arm's not attached to him in any way, but they've implanted 4 microchips into his brain, and they worked out where to implant them by using imaging and seeing which bits were active when he thought about moving his hand or when he touched things. And through these electrodes, the arm will send signals to the electrodes when it's touched, and he says he feels it in like his real nerves that still work, so he can feel it in his body. And also when he thinks about moving his hand, those thought patterns are read by the chips and sent to the arm, and it actually moves.
That is amazing.
Yeah, he's like shaken hands and fist bumped Barack Obama via this robot arm.
Wow.
That's pretty
so
cool.
Jen, tell me about these receptionists. What is that?
So this was news last week that people are being put off from making doctor's appointments because you have to sometimes talk to the receptionist about what your ailment is people, I think, feel like they're gatekeeping a little bit, because people worry that they'll be perceived as making a fuss and overreacting, and so they don't make doctor's appointments because they don't want to have that conversation with the receptionist to try and then make an appointment. And I think I am probably a culprit of this as well. I kind of think, oh, well, I don't want to waste their time. It's probably just the sniffles, and I wait until things get worse.
Or you go into your kitchen and you make an ancient remedy for yourself.
Yeah, or I just go and look at a 17th century book and see what they would do, purge some humours and carry on with my day.
And the Mars lander, this has only happened like really recently, hasn't it?
Yeah, so this was, what happened was the Schiaparelli lander was supposed to touch down on Mars, but they lost contact with it. So this Schiaparelli lander is part of a bigger mission from the European Space Agency called ExoMars, and it took off in March. And when it arrived at Mars, there was one craft that went into orbit around Mars and another one that attempted to land. And that attempted to land. And the way it worked is that it was supposed to go into the atmosphere and deploy a parachute until it slowed down a bit, and then when it got close enough to the surface, it would fire some rockets and land safely. But unfortunately, the parachute seems to have detached at some point, and the rockets only fired for a few seconds.
Was it, they were supposed to go off for like 30 seconds, weren't they? And yeah, I think they went off for 3 or 4, which is probably not enough to slow you down.
Yeah, no. Exactly. And so there's a little bit of speculation that possibly it landed during a storm, and maybe something wasn't quite right, so they had some problems. But just 2 days ago, they actually took some images from the Mars orbiter, which is the NASA craft that's going around the Mars at the moment, and they saw that the lander had generated a small dark impact crater on the surface.
Okay, so it's definitely a crash.
Chances are, it's crashed.
It's never going to be speaking to us again.
No.
That's such a shame, though. It's yet another one that hasn't quite worked.
Yeah.
Luckily, it is like a test, and there's going to be another rover that launches in 2020, and they still got all the data back from it. So they're calling it kind of a success because they got their data. They know roughly how it went down and what the problems
what
are.
What went so wrong, so they can fix.
Yeah, well, hopefully they can fix it for next time.
Yeah, I've been reading all this stuff about Elon Musk and his great plans to, you know, send people to Mars by 2028, and then you have something crash like that and you're like, oh, we're just really not sure that we'll be ready by 2028.
Yeah, maybe give it a few years.
On to your fifth song, please, Jen.
Okay, so this one is my guilty pleasure. Academics, I don't know if your listeners will know this, but academics, when we write something, have to send it off for what's called peer review. So it goes out anonymously to other people in our field who read it and send us feedback anonymously. Sometimes it's a little bit blunt. Sometimes it can feel like you're being trolled. It is all very professional normally, but sometimes it's pretty harsh. And so this is my guilty pleasure. I put Taylor Swift, Shake It Off, on really loudly if I get bad feedback, and just shake it off. But I keep cruising, can't stop, won't stop grooving. It's like I got this music in my mind saying it's gonna be all right. Cause the players gonna play, 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 play.
In Mesopotamia, doctors made a diagnosis not by inspecting the patient, but by examining the livers of sacrificed sheep.
Lots of animals in ancient medicine. That's what I'm taking from this.
Yeah, that's a little bit gross.
So we've talked a bit about men and masculinity, but what were some of the kind of ancient crazy medical ideas around women and their illnesses?
So this is an era when a lot's up for grabs, and the woman's body is still seen as kind of mysterious and a little bit unknown. I know we said earlier they discovered the eggs in this era, so they are making progress, if that's what we want to call it, but women's bodies are still a little bit uncertain and a bit of an unknown entity.
They're just cold and flabby.
Yeah, cold and phlegmy and a bit leaky and gross, but it means that there's a whole bunch of diseases that they think about then that we now would think are just crazy. We don't have them anymore. And the first one of those is related very much to the cold, wet kind of thinking. And it's a disease called the whites, which is just excess vaginal discharge. Mm-hmm. Normally white, but sometimes various colours, depending on which medical book that you read. And one of the reasons the whites is so fascinating is that as I mentioned earlier, venereal disease is running rampant across England and Europe at this time. And one of the first symptoms of venereal disease is a shedding of seminal matter, what they call a gleet. So again, a running of discharge. And so you get these kind of stories where medical writers are saying that there are some women who don't receive the treatment that they need because they think they've got the whites, but actually their dubious and bad husband has slept somewhere else
and
given them the pox, yeah. And they don't know what's wrong with them, and so they're not getting treated properly. But then they also worry about kind of deceitful women, and this is an on-running theme in a lot of medical discussions, is the deceitful nature of a woman's body. And they think that immoral women are going to the doctor and saying, oh, I've got the whites, can you treat me, knowing full well that they've got venereal disease,
but not wanting to admit it.
And so they're trying to con their doctors into giving them an astringent treatment that will stop this kind of flowing, but it's actually venereal disease and they've been very naughty.
Oh.
The next one, which is one of my personal favourites, it's one that I like to talk about with my students because it's so unusual, is the green sickness. Again,
what
colours.
Is that?
So the green sickness afflicts pubescent girls mm-hmm. as they come into adulthood, and it's when they struggle to breathe, they start fainting a lot, they become very pale, and they sometimes have a green tinge, hence the name, the green sickness. And it's believed to be caused by a build-up of fluids within the body, particularly seed or menstrual blood. And the remedy that's suggested for the green sickness is marriage, because marriage and sexual intercourse will unblock everything and release the seed that's been building up inside the body, and will restore these young girls' health. And this is another one that's really interesting with kind of social beliefs around it. So you get some songs printed in the 17th century about green sickness. And the message of the song is really to fathers, and is marry your daughter off quickly, because if she gets the green sickness, she might look for her own lusty young man of a remedy somewhere else, and he might not be the appropriate choice. And so there's these kind of warnings to fathers about
in that
women's
social
sexual
way,
drive. Yeah.
Do you think they've almost kind of invented it, and it's just like normal teenage grumpiness, but actually it's like, oh, you've got to marry off your daughter, and it's all kind of convention and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, it's a bit tricky. Some historians have tried to figure out what the equivalent might be, and some people have said that maybe it's anorexia nervosa, because the girls tend to be quite thin. But it's just one of those ones we can't match up with modern society. We just don't have it anymore. So we're not really
sure what was
going on. And then the last one, my absolute favourite, affected married women predominantly, and again is based on the fact they don't really know what's going on inside women's bodies, and it's called fits of the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where the womb rises up inside the body and compresses the diaphragm, and so makes it very difficult for women to breathe, and again you get the fainting and the kind of shortness of breath that's going on.
Oh, so I remember studying history and philosophy of science, and they talked about the wandering womb at some point. So this is the time of the wandering womb.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy.
And what I find particularly interesting about the wandering of the womb is the way that they try to cure it.
Mm.
And to do this, they use smell, which seems completely ridiculous to us. But in the 17th century, some medical writers are saying that the womb is similar to the brain, and the brain obviously has a sense of smell through the nose. And so the womb must have a sense of smell
Obviously.
I should point out there are some medical writers who are also saying, you're all idiots, it doesn't have a sense of smell. It's also tied down by ligaments, it's not going anywhere, this is ridiculous. But those that believe that the womb is attracted to sweet smells and is repulsed by horrible, nasty smells. So the treatment is either to burn something like partridge feathers under the nose, which generates a terrible smell, and so the womb will run away and go back down the body to where it should be, or to put something nice and sweet smelling. For them, they think civet and musk, which aren't that nice of smells to modern people, but still used in perfumes. And you place that at the vagina, and that will pull the womb back down as it will travel towards the sweet and nice smells.
So maybe next time someone has period pains, we'll just be like, spray some nice smells on your...
Yeah, I should say, I can't condone any actions like that, but that's probably not going to work, but you might have a nice smell in the room.
Right, well, I think it's time to see how our own remedy has done. So, producer Kyle, if you could just bring it through. Now, there's one more thing we need to do, isn't there?
Yeah, so the final step for this is to dissolve in our 8 spoonfuls of sugar. And sugar is a very common component in early modern remedies, as is wine, actually. And once that's dissolved in and mixed in, we can give it a try. And if you were taking this at the time, you'd need to be taking some spoonfuls every morning and every evening until the remedies completely run out. And that's your course of treatment.
Now, do we leave the currants in, or do we kind of strain them out?
Well, the recipe doesn't say to strain them out, so I would be tempted to leave them in. But part of the problem with these recipes is that they're somewhat like mnemonics. They're kind of memory prods, and so they don't always have all the instructions. So I think either way, we're perfectly fine.
Okay, well, I'm going to take a taste.
Mmm! Are you feeling better already?
Oh my God, so much better. It's delicious. Yeah, it's kind of like sweet, and the currants are nice and juicy. Have a taste.
Give this a go. I would happily eat that.
Twice a day, definitely. Mm. I think they're onto something.
I think that much wine first thing in the morning might be a problem.
It is quite syrupy. I could see that kind of soothing your throat.
Yeah, it tastes great. It tastes like Christmas.
Mm. It does taste like Christmas.
Cool. We should talk to Boots. Right. All we've got time for now is to reveal the answer to our two brain teasers. Producer Carl, have we had any guesses on the Twitter?
Well, so someone did say, did they think that they thought that the falling sickness was fainting?
Oh, that's a really good guess. That totally makes sense.
It's close. It's not quite right. So the falling sickness in the 17th century is epilepsy. So it's the same idea that you're struck with a seizure and you fall down. So that's where the name comes from. So they're very close.
Ah. And I know that Jen, your husband, has had a particularly good idea for the other sillier brain teaser.
Yeah. So he thinks that the nuts that will give you a cold, is it?
Mm-hmm. The nuts that will give you a cold.
He thinks it might be a horse chestnut.
So good.
Horse that chestnut. Oh, what about it's not a nut? But maybe coffee.
Yeah. I love it. Both of those are excellent, I have to say. Excellent puns, and it is another kind of pun. I almost think his is better. So the nuts that will give you a cold are cashews.
Very good.
And on that sickly note, it's time for me to say thank you so much for joining us, Jen. It's been absolutely fascinating. What is your final song?
So my final song is my kind of new discovery. I know he's not that new to everyone else, but he's new to me. And it's Ray LaMontagne, You Are the Best Thing.
It's like you see right through me and make it easier. Believe me, you don't even have to try.
Soho Radio.
Soho Radio.
You're listening to Soho Radio.
Soho Radio.
Soho Radio.
Soho Radio.
Soho Radio.